From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Members of the Congress, it is my great privilege, and I deem it a high honor and personal pleasure, to present to you His Excellency Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel.
The Israeli Prime Minister addresses a joint session of Congress. We'll hear from Professor Noam Chomsky, a well-known critic of Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. We'll speak with Maxine Waters about affirmative action and the California Civil Rights Initiative. And the International Conference on AIDS is wrapping up in Vancouver. We'll hear the perspective of an AIDS activist. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. One day after former Colorado Governor Richard Lamm announced he would seek the Reform Party's presidential nomination, party founder Ross Perot says he, too, will take the job if asked. Perot says he will make a second White House bid if he's nominated by the Reform Party, which he created in the wake of his 1992 run. 4 years ago, Perot spent $60 million of his own money and took 19% of the vote. Speaking of money, a former vice chair of Bob Dole's campaign finance committee has agreed to pay a record $6 million in fines for funneling illegal contributions through his employees to the Dole camp and other political causes. If the plea agreement entered by Simon Fireman is approved by a federal judge as expected, it would be by far the largest penalty in U.S. history for illegal campaign contributions. Fireman, the owner of Aqualeisure Industries in Boston, was accused of getting employees of his company to make contributions and then reimbursing them through a cash flume running to Hong Kong and then back to the United States. Fireman is the uncle of Paul Fireman, the CEO of Reebok. A similar bundling scheme occurred in the 1998 Dole presidential campaign. Employees reportedly were ordered to contribute and later got reimbursed by the Kansas firm Birdview Satellite Communications. I'm reading now from The Buying of the President, a new book on the presidential campaigns. It says, when the story broke in the midst of the 1988 presidential primaries, Dole's staff denied that he had done anything wrong. The senator, who said he knew nothing of the donations, called for an internal and a federal election commission probe into the matter, and the staff promised that if any illegal money was received from Birdview employees, it would be returned. FEC officials, however, have no record of any request from Dole to look into the Birdview matter. And Bob Dole is getting some criticism for a speech he didn't make. Black members of Congress yesterday said Dole was wrong to decide against attending the annual convention of the NAACP. New Jersey Democrat Donald Payne says Dole has sent a loud and clear message that he's not interested in the concerns of black Americans. President Clinton did address the NAACP convention yesterday. He talked about gun control, gang control, welfare reform, civil rights, and the burning of black churches.
I know that even though we desegregated our schools and threw racism out of public facilities and elected African Americans and Hispanics and Asian Americans to Congress, passed civil rights laws, this job is a never-ending job here and around the world. It's a never-ending job. That's why, notwithstanding the political movement of the moment, after I studied it for several months, I thought we could and should make some changes in the affirmative action laws, but that we should mend them and not end them. I thought it would be a mistake to end them and walk away. I think it's a mistake not to try to keep working for voting rights and greater impact of voting rights, and notwithstanding the recent Supreme Court decisions, which of course we will all honor, we still have to be on a mission of making sure that the Congress of the United States represents the American people in a fair and full way. And it's why we have to keep standing against this rash of church burnings.
And that, of course, President Clinton yesterday addressing the NAACP convention. And finally, denying that he still harbors any racist or Nazi views, David Duke entered the race for the U.S. Senate yesterday, pledging to fight to preserve America's white Christian heritage. He joined two major Democrats in Louisiana and four other Republicans filing as candidates for the seat held by retiring Senator Bennett Johnston. You're listening to Democracy Now! This Saturday in Los Angeles, Congresswoman Maxine Waters is holding a town meeting on the subject of affirmative action. An initiative is on the California ballot this November that would ban affirmative action in the state. The measure is being called the California Civil Rights Initiative, but many of its critics are calling it the California Civil Wrongs Initiative. We're joined by Larry Bensky in Berkeley, our national affairs correspondent, and from a cloakroom in the Rayburn Building, we're joined by Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, why don't we begin with this affirmative action town hall meeting you're having on Saturday? What are you going to be talking about?
The affirmative action town hall meeting that's co-hosted by both me and Julian Dixon, who's from the adjacent congressional district to mine, is one where we hope to do two things. Advance the information on the president's Mend It, Don't End It program, so that people are in a position to comment on it. There is a comment period that ends on July 22nd, and the president is soliciting comments on the Mend It, Don't End It program, so that his proposal, rather, so that when he writes his final version of Mend It, Don't End It, he will do it with the input, the advice and information coming from people all over this country. Secondly, we will also have present those who are working on the ballot initiative, the so-called Civil Rights Initiative in California, so that we will share information about what that is, what it will do, and help people to understand what it is.
Congressman Waters, for our listeners in Southern California, KPFK Los Angeles, could you say where and when that meeting is taking place?
This meeting is going to take place at the Museum of Science and Industry in Exposition Park in Los Angeles. That would be on Figueroa, just north of Santa Barbara.
And when?
That is Saturday at 10 o'clock, this coming Saturday, July 13th.
Yesterday, former Colorado Governor Richard Lamm was here in Northern California in San Jose pushing his newly announced candidacy for the Reform Party nomination for president. And knowing that we were going to talk to you today, I thought I'd get his take on affirmative action, and I'd like to get your reaction to what he said when I asked him whether or not he supported or didn't support CCRI and his general approach to affirmative action. Here's what he said.
I started the first affirmative action program in Colorado. I have put together a decade of reform and renewal, and one of the things that I've said in that decade is that I think affirmative action ought to continue time-limited. I think that it ought to be in the neighborhood of, let's say, in this decade. At the end of the decade, I think that affirmative action should stop. I think it is against the meritorious principles generally of America. But I do think that that it's been a useful institution, and I'm for continuing it for 10 years.
What about that concept that affirmative action is against what Governor Lamm calls the meritorious principles
of
America?
Well, I think, first of all, what he said was he thinks it's valid, that it has merit, and that he was involved not only in instituting but supporting affirmative action. I think that's the first thing we must identify. Secondly, he wishes an end to come to it. All of us agree that we wish an end would have to come to the need to have affirmative action. You have affirmative action because you're attempting to right the wrongs of past and present. There has been discrimination. There has been exclusion. There has not been opportunities opened up to a whole segment of our society. If, in fact, somehow we could do that tomorrow and end it, it would be my hope that it could end as quickly as possible. None of us, those of us who had to fight for affirmative action, would like to see it go on forever, because that would be to agree that exclusion and racism and discrimination will exist forever. Most of us don't believe that America wants to write that bottom line. So I'm hopeful that there will be an end to affirmative action, and I think that will reveal itself. The only thing that I would disagree with it is hard to put a time certain on such things, because you don't know if the job will have been done in 2 years, 5 years, or 4 years. But let me tell you, if it's done within the next 6 months, I would be the first to agree we don't need it anymore.
Congresswoman Maxine Waters, Ralph Nader has said that President Clinton is too unprincipled to lose the California primary, meaning that he moves to the right every time Dole raises an issue and outrights him. Now, on the affirmative action issue, after Senate Majority Leader at the time, Dole, called for a review of affirmative action and basically ending it, President Clinton also called for that review. Do you have confidence that he is going to hold the line?
Well, let me just say this. I understand in an election year that something like affirmative action is a hot political potato. And I also understand that there are very few politicians who are so pure that they will absolutely go against what they think is the grain of the voters and do necessarily what is the right thing. Very few politicians do that, unfortunately. I think that Clinton believes that affirmative action has merit. I think that he has an eye toward how much trouble does he get in by becoming an advocate of affirmative action, or can he take a position that would have to balance the support and the lack of support for affirmative action and say, let's take a look at it and see what's good about it. If the review is being called for, I will agree to that. Let's review it. Let's take a look at the court decisions at Adiran, see if there's anything in existing law that flies in the face of Adiran, and let me see if I can't save it, but fix that which appears to not comply with what Adiran talks about as strict scrutiny. So I understand what's going on. I'm appreciative for the effort of the president. He could have taken the easy way out and said, oh, my goodness, we're at a time when this nation is polarized. We're at a time when affirmative action sounds as if it is something for people who are non-deserving. Let me just run away from it altogether. He didn't do that. I want to tell you, these are tough times, and for people like me who happen to be African-American, who are fighting and struggling all the time just for a little justice and equality, when we have a win, we take it and we keep fighting.
Congressman Waters, do you think President Clinton in particular and the Democratic Party in general needs to have a little of what we used to call street heat on this subject? Do you think that there should be, for example, demonstrations outside the Democratic Convention in Chicago this summer by African-Americans and others who want to see the party take a stronger stand on issues like this?
Well, I think you are going to have demonstrations by African-Americans and others outside of the Democratic Party. I think whether you talk about Latinos, African-American, Americans, or others who would like a more progressive Democratic Party, you're going to see the voices of those who are not happy that our party is what they would envision in a Democratic Party. Many people are worried that it's moving to the center, to the right. And so, yes, you're going to see those voices emerge at the Democratic Convention.
How are people
be out there? I was just going to ask Amy if the congresswoman is going to be out there with him. You go to which side of that wall at the Democratic Convention are you going to be on, Congresswoman Waters?
Well, what you normally find Maxine Waters doing is two things. One, always with the people, always accessible, always rallying with them when I think they have a point of view, but also on the inside, where I use my muscle as much as I possibly can to make the party what I think it ought to be. I operate from both angles, and I've been able to do it over the past 20 years and do a pretty good job at it.
Will you be addressing, making a major address at the Democratic National Convention as you did in 92?
I have not been asked by anybody to make a major address at the Democratic Party. Don't know if I will be invited to do that by the DNC or the president or the White House.
Well, if they don't invite you, you just come to the Pacifica booth. I think we can probably find time for you.
We can always find a forum. Thank you very much. I'll take you up on that invitation.
Larry, how are people organizing in California for this California Civil Rights Initiative? Who's behind it?
Well, let me tell you what's happening. There is a very strong coalition that's come together, and that coalition is made up of women's groups.
This is who's going against it.
against it. That's right. That's who you're talking about. Right.
No, I was talking about who is organizing for it.
Oh, well, basically, it has been led by the two professors who started this whole thing. And they're out just trying to whip up angry people, trying to whip up misinformed people, misinforming people. They don't have the great corporation signed on the dotted line. They have Pete Wilson. They have some Republican politicians. And they have, the so-called disaffected.
Congressman Waters, if I could switch the topic slightly, a couple of days ago we had the Georgia primary, which we talked about here before and afterward, where two African-American Congress colleagues of yours who had been redistricted out of their predominantly black districts into districts that were more overwhelmingly white in votership, not only survived their primaries, but won by very, very unexpected and large margins. And this has led all kinds of speculation to happen over again about what might happen this fall under new guidelines for electoral districts in the South. There's a school of thought, and I'd like to get your thinking about this, that if the black voting power was diluted out of overwhelmingly African-American districts into other districts, it could result in the election of more Democrats who would not necessarily be African-American, but would enable the Democratic Party to get the shift of 20 seats, which you need to take over the House of Representatives again from the Republicans. This would mean, for example, Congressman Conyers would chair the Judiciary Committee, Congressman Rangel might chair Ways and Means, Dellums on National Security, etc. You might have fewer members, African-American members in Congress, but you would have African-American members with enormous power as committee chairs. How do you see that question?
Well, let me just tell you that those members of Congress who now find themselves at the pinnacle of power, defined by being a chairperson of a committee, have worked hard and they have long seniority and they deserve the opportunity to do that. If we have to basically say that we can't put ourselves up for election because whites don't like us enough to vote for us, that's a hard pill to swallow. Not a hard pill to swallow that we're not liked enough, but a hard pill to swallow to say that racism still is so profound in this country that we can't present ourselves and our competence and our desires to want to serve in a way that would cause us to be judged just as others would be judged. And somehow we have to settle for the fact that our cause must be advanced by whites because they're more acceptable. I don't think that's the side that I come down on. I think I really come down on the side of trying to work in every way that I possibly can to overcome the racism, to overcome the fear, to overcome the prejudice, so that even if it means that it delays our opportunity to serve in ways that you just described, that we must do that. We must never recede from the struggle because somehow we're unacceptable as black people. I just can't swallow that. I can't buy that. I guess I have to believe that people are better than sometimes they act, and that there's always an opportunity to change minds, and that's what our struggle must be about, no matter how long it takes. I guess that's where I come down.
Congresswoman Waters, let me change the subject again to the issue of abortion. Now, we all know about the controversy in the Republican Party and what's going to happen at the Republican convention. What about what's happening today, a committee beginning to draft the Democratic platform? Now, Democrats have already been meeting in private to talk about the issue of abortion. Ohio Congressmember Tony Hall is calling on the party to recognize the right of members to abide by their conscience on the abortion issue. And so, in essence, they're also calling for a kind of tolerance plank to be put in. What do you think of that?
Well, let me tell you, when I look at what Dole was able to do, it is nothing. It's window dressing. It's window dressing to try and get around the real deep problem that they have with Republicans inside that party who are saying we're tired of these men basically telling us that they and we cannot support the right to choice. Now, if Tony Hall and others are so jealous of that plank that they want to put something in that says, and we too recognize that there are people with different opinions. Personally, I don't have any problems with it, and I don't think we should get divided about it. I think if they want to copycat the Republicans with a meaningless preamble, that's where it is. It's not even in the actual planks themselves, in a meaningless preamble that recognizes there are some people who don't believe in it, that's all right by me. I don't think that changes the direction of the Democratic Party at all. It does not frighten me. We're not going backwards. It doesn't create anything in our party except to say there are a few people who don't agree with us.
Congresswoman Waters, we have to take a break. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
All right, thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington. Larry Bensky joins us from California. And we're also joined by Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California. She's now in the cloakroom next to a hearing room she's about to go into for a hearing on the constitutional amendment, the first constitutional amendment that President Clinton supports around the issue of victims' rights. But we wanted to turn to the issue of immigration. Larry, yesterday you were covering Dick Lamb, the new Reform Party candidate for president. And he was talking about that.
Right. And he was asked how he would have voted on Proposition 187, the measure that passed by a 2-to-1 margin here in California a couple of years ago that would restrict social services and educational benefits to immigrants. Here's what he said.
If I lived in California, I would have voted for Proposition 187. My wife would have voted against it. We had the normal kind of argument and compassion question, but let me tell you, I've been fighting all my life to cover poor people with health care, and I can't do that if I have to cover anybody that comes here from outside of the country. My new definition of compassion is that the price of compassion is restriction. That if you know, if everybody, you know, if you owe a duty to everybody, then you're really going to end up having a duty to nobody. So I think we should compassionately, and I stress the compassionately, but we have to find a way where American taxpayers only fund people legally in this country.
What about that, Congresswoman Waters? The new definition of compassion is restriction.
it sounds like a contradiction to me. Let me just say this. I recognize that we have some problems with people who are coming across the border, and they are undocumented. And, you know, we have limited resources by which to apply to all of our systems. However, this country is on record in support of the idea of the melting pot, where we have welcomed with open arms immigrants who have come from Europe, who have come from other places. I think that the fear about Mexico is a fear that is a fear about people who are coming across the border and somehow overburdening those systems more than other immigrants have. Most of the people who come across the border take all of these menial jobs. They clean, they mop, they work in our restaurants, our hospitals, and they do jobs that a lot of people won't take. They're exploited even after they come here, not only on their minimum wage jobs, they're on jobs where they're not even getting paid minimum wage, and they pay back into the Social Security system. They pay back into the tax system. So I don't think we should be so hard on them. What I think we should do is we should recognize that we have people who are here and they must be educated. To talk about not educating the children of undocumented immigrants is foolhardy. It means that you're talking about relegating a whole generation of young kids to ignorance and illiteracy who are going to be living here anyway. And I don't think we want to do that. I think we should secure the borders and make sure that we have policies that allow people in with formulas the way that we think we are doing, so that we can have a handle on the people who are coming, and we can be of assistance and make sure that they are integrated into our society in ways that they can have a good quality of life and that we can be accepting of the contributions they make. I am not for harming children and families who are trying to find a better quality of life, who are trying to escape hunger, who are trying to come to the great country that said, you know, we welcome you, or said it some time ago, we welcome you. So I don't like the harshness of the policies against Mexicans that Lamb and others would support. I just think that, again, it's one of those issues that's been used in a political way. It's very polarizing, and it does not do us any good to set them up as the bad people, the people that's troublesome to our society, that's causing us problems. I think we can do better than that, and we can plan better than that.
Congressmember Waters, we are throwing a lot of issues at you, but I wanted to ask you about the church arson issue, the burning of black churches.
Yes.
Yesterday, you were in the Rose Garden. The CBC, the Congressional Black Caucus, was congratulating, I guess, white Congress members for taking the lead on the church arson bill that passed so quickly that it would increase penalties for those who set fire to churches. But I wanted to ask you about President Clinton's position on the black churches. He's certainly taken a lead in terms of speaking out on it. But why hasn't he called the church burnings, so many of which have happened in the past year and a half, domestic terrorism? Some are saying the reason he doesn't want to do that now is because the Atlanta Olympics are happening and he doesn't want people from around the world to be hearing about terrorism on our soil, as they talk about terrorism internationally. But wouldn't that elevate the whole investigation to a new level if you called it terrorism?
But you know what? I was asked that question a few weeks ago. I am not prepared to do that myself. And let me tell you why. I think sometimes new terminology takes the direct focus off of some actions in ways that we may not want it to. Domestic terrorism is all-encompassing, and it kind of takes the focus off the fact that churches are being burned, and it puts it into this generic category of actions that are being taken against not only churches but federal buildings and all of what appears to be the new terrorism. And while we must deal with that, I think that this issue of keeping the focus on the churches is very important because it shames people. It shames people in ways that other issues do not. As a matter of fact, I don't know anybody who says, well, that's not my issue, or it's only black churches, or it's just Jewish churches, synagogues, rather, or it's just white churches. What happens is you have the left and the right and the in-between all saying, well, that's wrong. That's against God and country, and we can't stand for that. And I think it's good to have to force people at least to act as if they're better than they are oftentimes.
Well,
and
then why
don't... If it takes God and church to do that, and it takes God and church to have a read acting like a decent human being, so be it. Let it keep being focused on church burnings, black churches predominantly. I like the idea that they have to focus on the fact that it takes us back to what happened during the civil rights days when they burned and bombed churches. And so I'm not worried about him not casting it as domestic terrorism.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I'd like to get your quick reaction to something that happened here in California the other day. You served in the California legislature for, 14 years, seven terms, I think it was. And you talk about definitions of domestic terrorism. The other day, the legislature approved a budget, I know you still follow this closely, which cut back the payments to families, AFDC, families of dependent children,
by
5%. 75% of the people who get that money are children under 9. That would be my definition of domestic terrorism. At the same time, the legislature was cutting the corporate and bank taxes by 5%. At the same time, they were cutting payments to poor children and infants.
It's outrageous.
You say the center and the left and the right have to get together about black churches. Where are they on issues like this?
Well, to tell you the truth, nothing is going to happen to turn this around until we take back the California legislature, until we take back the Congress, and we take back all the legislative bodies that are run by Republicans. Republicans are defining themselves in ways that a lot of people have not understood in the past 10, 15 years. These are right-wingers who don't give a darn about children. These are terrorists. These are people who are mean, who don't give a darn whether or not those children are hungry, whether or not they have a place to live. And let me tell you something. This should cause people to hit the streets, to register, to vote, to get rid of them. Anybody who said a few years ago, a few months ago, there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, gosh darn it, I hope they're seeing it now. These kinds of policy decisions that are defining who they really are, what they don't care about, who they do care about, and I guess if this does not propel people into action, I don't know what will. We can't change their mind by appealing to their humanitarianism. They're not humanistic. They're not people who care. And so we've got to get rid of them, and that's the bottom line.
Congressmember Waters, I know you have to go into your constitutional subcommittee hearing, so thank you very much for joining us on Democracy Now!
You're certainly welcome.
And, of course, Congresswoman Maxine Waters is from California, speaking to us from a cloakroom in the Rayburn Building. And thanks very much, Larry, for joining us. Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent. Up next, we're going to talk about the AIDS conference in Vancouver.
I'm gonna stay on the battlefield. I'm gonna stay on the battlefield. I'm gonna stay on the battlefield till I
that Maxine Waters could be singing that song, as could our next guest, Bob Lederer, an AIDS activist. The International AIDS Conference in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, is wrapping up. The most hopeful news at the conference is the development of a promising new category of medications called protease inhibitors. Some believe these drugs could turn HIV into a manageable rather than deadly disease. But the medication is extremely expensive and completely out of reach for the vast majority of people living with AIDS around the world. We're now joined by Bob Lederer. He is a member of ACT UP in New York. He's also a producer at our Pacifica station in New York, WBAI. And he's covering the AIDS conference for PAS, the magazine by, for, and about people living with HIV and AIDS. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bob.
Good morning, Amy.
Why don't you summarize for us what has been going on at the International Conference on AIDS that you're attending?
Okay, well, you've certainly put your finger on absolutely the headline story coming out of this conference all week long. The new combination approaches to treating AIDS using these protease inhibitors together with older drugs are the talk of the town, and definitely for understandable reasons, given that that blood tests are showing a tremendous reduction in the amount of virus in people using these drugs, plus a lot of incredible stories of dramatic recoveries, particularly from people who were heading downhill very fast, and some results that seem to sustain themselves over time.
These are people who take protease inhibitors. They were doing badly, and then they do much better?
That's right. However, the reality is, as you pointed out, there are several gigantic problems with looking to this as anything approaching a cure or even something making AIDS chronic and manageable. Of course, first and foremost is the outrageous price of these drugs. The combinations with the older ones bring the tab to anywhere from $12,000 to $15,000 a year per person. But beyond all that, they involve very complicated regimens involving staggering one's meals and being careful about timing. So that's going to make a lot of difficulties in compliance in patients being able to actually follow all the rules. And they also have some side effects that appear to gradually become cumulative and make it more and more difficult to continue taking them. So many people are saying, and even the organizers of the conference acknowledge, is that this is not the answer, and we are very, very far from a cure. But that's not what some of the leaders of the medical establishment have been saying, and the media have been really going quite far in implying that the cure is virtually here.
Bob, I wanted to get a sense from you about what the picture is at the International AIDS Conference. When I covered it a number of years ago, and when it took place in San Francisco, you had the activists outside the convention. They were protesting. They were getting arrested. You had people inside, and you had a tremendous conflict between states, particularly the United States and the activists. I remember when the head of Health and Human Services stood up to speak, AIDS activists turned their backs, and they shouted, "Shame, shame, shame." What's happening in Vancouver?
Well, it's interesting how I've covered five conferences now, and there have been some dramatic changes, and yet some things that are virtually the same dynamic. On the one hand, activists have now been very much brought into the planning process. A long-term survivor and founder of ACT UP New York was on the planning committee and, in fact, was given one of the opening speeches in which he denounced pharmaceutical company price gouging and government indifference to massive human rights violations and continued killings of people with AIDS. And there were some people with AIDS on panels at the conference, and more topics that community representatives have been pushing for to be discussed on panels. And yet, on the other hand, there continues to be posturing by governments and the need for protests against a whole range of policies by both government and corporations that activists believe are responsible for maintaining the horrible death rate of this epidemic. So as a result, the scene that you described from 1990, where people turned their backs and shouted down Bush's health secretary, was played out virtually identically, but this time by the Canadian AIDS activists, who were outraged that the Canadian Prime Minister, Chrétien, refused to come, just as Bush had refused to come. And it's normally been a tradition at other conferences that the head of state opens the conference. But more substantively, that Canada's government has recently decided not to renew the major program funding AIDS services and research in Canada, and providing a lifeline for many people with AIDS to get treatment. So there was that scene played out at the opening ceremony, which led the health minister to say 2 days later that he had suddenly gotten a cold and couldn't attend the rest of the conference. Something not quite the same, but in a similar vein, happened to the U.S. Health Secretary, Donna Shalala, who did make a speech at one of the sessions, but was to attend a signing ceremony of a declaration with the Health Minister of Canada and Mexico, a sort of a NAFTA of the AIDS world, which simply pledged their countries to cooperate in fighting AIDS, really what activists viewed as a completely meaningless two-paragraph document. And when ACT UP announced plans to protest several U.S. government policies, she canceled that public event. So there's been while the activist protests have mainly been inside the conference and have been accepted by conference officials, there have been no arrests by legitimate activists, although there have been some arrests by a renegade group that that calls itself ACT UP San Francisco that engages in disruption and actually violence against individuals. But aside from the arrests of those people, which have been repudiated by all the ACT UP chapters around the world who are gathered here, it's been a more cordial relationship with the conference organizers, but not with the people who are underwriting this conference, which are the major multinational pharmaceutical companies who produce AIDS drugs and AIDS diagnostic tests.
Could you say, Bob, could you say in a word your feelings about the two leading presidential contenders, Bob Dole on AIDS and also President Clinton?
Yes, I think it's the widespread feeling among AIDS activists that both both candidates have fallen far short, and that Dole's policies have been shameful and Clinton's have been only slightly less shameful. And indeed, this week, timed for the conference, Clinton's own Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS issued a report that, while praising some of his policies as being better than the Republicans, excoriated him for several very severe lapses on refusing to put forward a national plan to fight AIDS, an overly timid federal AIDS prevention program, and the refusal to accept universally agreed scientific results that show that needle exchange for drug users is a proven way to reduce exposure to the virus.
Bob Letter, I want to thank you very much for waking up so early in British Columbia and talking to us. Again, Bob Letterer is covering the International AIDS Conference for PAWS, the magazine by, for, and about people living with HIV and AIDS. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back with Noam Chomsky in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the program that dares to ask the questions the corporate media won't. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in the United States this week, where he met with President Clinton and addressed a joint session of Congress. Today, Netanyahu is in New York to meet with GOP presidential candidate Bob Dole, Mayor Giuliani, and Governor George Pataki. By the way, he has said that by the end of his term, there will be a Hebrew word for deregulation. Netanyahu has spent more time with American politicians than he has with Palestinian leaders. He's yet to sit down with Yasser Arafat. In Hebron, in the occupied West Bank, Palestinian youth threw stones and bottles at Israeli soldiers after Netanyahu failed to follow through on a date, setting a date for withdrawing troops and asserted Israel's non-negotiable claims to Jerusalem. Netanyahu spoke the day before yesterday with President Clinton at a joint news conference, and this is what he had to say about Hebron.
We have a commitment to maintain security. And the problem in Hebron is a serious problem of security. No government, including the previous government, could act precipitously in Hebron because the potential for explosion there is immense. And it would be, it could entail the kind of tragedies that we saw in Hebron recently, or for that matter, a few decades ago in 1929, when the entire Jewish community was massacred. We've had terrible violence directed at both sides. Hebron to us is also a subject of deep historical attachment. It's the oldest Jewish community on earth, 3,500 years old. So this has to be treated carefully. I'm looking into the problem. I explained to President Clinton in some detail our concerns and how we seek to reconcile these two these two interests, fulfilling commitments on the one hand and maintaining security on the other. This is something I'll discuss with my cabinet colleagues, and I assure you that I'll be in touch with the president as we continue our deliberations.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington this week at a joint press conference with President Clinton. We're now joined by Noam Chomsky from Massachusetts. Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, author of, well, too many books to mention, but certainly a well-known critic of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Welcome, Professor Chomsky.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And can you tell us your response to Netanyahu's comments about Hebron and the occupation?
Well, one has to bear in mind that when he, or for that matter, any Israeli leader or commentator here use the term security, they mean it in the special racist sense of standard discourse here. It means security for Jews, not security for Arabs. So, for example, there's been big security problems, undoubtedly, in Hebron for years. The settlers have been rampaging, torturing, killing people, but that's not called a security problem. A dramatic example was after the Baruch Goldstein massacre at the Cave of the Patriarchs in Hebron, massacre of Palestinians, and in fact, measures were taken against Palestinians in response to that. So Hebron was the Palestinians were in Hebron. The were subjected to a very severe closure. Their downtown market was destroyed by soldiers and so on, because out of concern for the potential security of the Israeli settlers. And Netanyahu is not differing much from others in Israel or the United States in what he said.
What do you think about the new Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu overall, and what his tenure as Prime Minister will mean for the Palestinians? Do you think it's going to be better or worse than Peres and Rabin before him?
Chances are it won't be radically different. There has been a difference between the two major political groupings, Labor and Likud, over the years. But it's mostly a difference in style. In fact, it became clear, it was clearly made quite clear in the discussions that were published about the discussion between Clinton and Netanyahu. They are supposed to have disagreed in that Clinton wanted a restriction to expanding existing settlements, whereas Netanyahu refused to rule out establishing new settlements. Well, that's a mostly terminological difference. In the past, expanding of settlements or thickening settlements has just been a term that's been used to cover the extension of the whole settlement structure, which the U.S. substantially funds, incidentally. And the U.S. has much preferred, and American commentators have much preferred, the labor style. It's kind of more attuned to the norms. The more or less hypocritical norms of respectable discourse, in which you're not supposed to concede what's happening. You're supposed to deny it and then just notice later that it happened. The Likud has traditionally been more sort of in-your-face in its way of doing things, harder to ignore. And the U.S. didn't like that. It led to some tactical differences between the Bush and Shamir administration. They'd much prefer the labor style. On the other hand, it's very likely that Netanyahu will adopt the labor style. He's very Americanized. This is the most Americanized political leadership that Israel has ever had. There's some ironies there, and that their constituency is poorer sectors, nationalist, religious, and so on. But they themselves are not only Netanyahu, but his main foreign advisor, Dory Gold, and others are. Well, they could be running an American campaign, and nobody would notice it particularly. And that's a little different. And he will, I suspect, adapt probably easily to the preferred American style. There also are some policy differences. How significant they'll be, you wait and see. But one of them was, in fact, an important one, pointed out accurately in the New York Times report a couple days ago. It reported correctly that Gideon Ezra, who's has been very heavily involved in what they call anti-terrorist activities, that is, control of Palestinians in the occupied territory in the Secret Service, he pointed out, expressing Netanyahu's longstanding views, incidentally, pointed out that the closures, which are devastating to Palestinians, don't have any security purpose. They are just for the psychological measures for Israelis. Remember that these closures are instituted when there is any disturbance. It can be after a terrorist act by Palestinians, it can be after a terrorist act by Jews. Either way, the closure is against Palestinians and other measures of repression are against Palestinians.
And, of course, closure means that the Palestinians are not allowed out of the occupied territories.
Sometimes they're not allowed out of their houses. For example, after the Goldstein massacre, the people of Hebron were subjected to a literal curfew. And that's been done at other times. For example, a year later in Hebron again, during the Passover holidays, they wanted the 500 or so Jewish settlers there and about 30 or 40,000 Israeli tourists to be able to have picnics and, go around the city freely, not being disturbed by the presence of the 120,000 or so Arabs who live there. So they just subjected the inhabitants to a four-day house curfew. Well, it wasn't even any. In fact, there was plenty of security problems. The settlers and the tourists were rampaging and destroying and so on and so forth. But that's not a security problem. And on the other hand, however, it is important that it may be important that Netanyahu has held, and his now security advisor, Gideon Ezra, repeats that the closures are of no security significance. They are for other reasons, and he's been against them. A reduction of the closure could be a mildly helpful to Palestinians who are suffering very badly. The economic situation, particularly in Gaza, but even in the West Bank, has deteriorated very substantially since the Oslo agreements were instituted, and this could relieve them somewhat. On the other hand, he's much less likely to give the kind of rhetorical, vague rhetorical support for, potential self-determination and so on that was more the labor style.
Professor Chomsky, of course, the issue of terrorism has been raised over the last few days, both by President Clinton and by Netanyahu. It's been harped on continually at their joint press conference, certainly in Netanyahu's address to the joint session of Congress. I wanted to ask you about the cabinet that has just recently been chosen by Netanyahu. And I wanted you to respond to a comment of Mike McCurry, the spokesperson for President Clinton, when I asked him about one of those new cabinet members.
The president is going to be consistent in speaking out on terrorism. Doesn't he feel any need to speak out on the appointment of Ariel Sharon, considering he was the only minister to be kicked out of the cabinet because he presided over the killing of up to 1,000 Lebanese refugees?
Well, the history of the Sabra and Shatila events in Lebanon has been well rehearsed. The views of the United States government, which have not changed, were eloquently spoken at the time on those incidents.
And that was presidential spokesperson Mike McCurry. Professor Chomsky, your response?
Well, he rather understates the point. Sharon is—his terrorist career goes way back before his decisive role in the Sabra Shatila massacre. In fact, it goes back to the early 1950s when he was he directed the slaughter of about 70 people in the village of Kibya, another couple of dozen in the Alberig refugee camp right before that. In the early 1970s, he ran terrorist operations in the Gaza region and northeastern Sinai, which Israel was then occupying. That included expelling about 10,000 farmers into the desert, destroying their homes, bulldozing, you know, homes, mosques, graveyards, farmlands, preparing for Jewish settlement. The invasion of Lebanon itself was under his direction, and the terrorist attack on Beirut before the Sabra Shatila massacre was much worse than Sabra Shatila. It just wasn't, you know, opposed by the United States, so it's not considered terrorism. And in fact, throughout the invasion, there was massive terrorism, and it continues. He is one of the leading terrorists of the region. It's pretty hard to find a counterpart. On the other hand, one should bear in mind that, say, Shimon Peres also has quite an extensive career as a leading international terrorist. So, for example, he was responsible for the terrorist bombing of Tunis, in which 75 Palestinians, Lebanese and mostly Tunisians and Palestinians, mostly Tunisians, were killed. No credible pretext was even offered. The United States, in fact, supported that. He was responsible directly for the violent terrorist operations of the Israeli army in 1985 when they were being forced out of Lebanon resistance, and they reacted under Peres with extreme violence, reported mostly in overseas, but even sometimes here and extensively in the Israeli press, and on and on. It's not that while Sharon is unique, is unusual in his dedication to terrorism in a career going back to the early 1950s, he's not alone.
Rafael Eitan has also been appointed to the cabinet, and I guess Israeli papers have just been reporting, exposing the fact that during the Suez War, that he was responsible for ordering the killings of Egyptian POWs and Egyptian civilians.
Yeah, he's also an old terrorist, goes back to the 1950s, like Sharon. His own position has been perfectly clear. In fact, he made a famous statement some years, I think it must have been about in the early 1980s, when he and Sharon were responsible for pretty violent repression in the territories, that as the Jews continued to settle the West Bank, that the problem would be overcome and the Palestinians who remained there would be like drugged roaches scurrying around in a bottle. And that expresses his point of view.
Professor Chomsky, we only have a minute to go, but I wanted to end on presidential politics in this country. We often say that on foreign policy, President Clinton and Robert Dole have very little disagreement. What about on the issue of Israel and the occupied territories?
You may notice that yesterday when Netanyahu repeated what has been, in fact, also the labor position, that Jerusalem would remain Israel's capital undivided, the Palestinians would have no rights, Republicans and Democrats jointly got up and applauded. On Israel, they don't. Clinton, in fact, has been unusual, extreme. It's been remarked in the Israeli press since he came in his the extreme hawkish nature of his positions, which is without precedent, even in the history of overwhelming U.S. support for extremist Israeli positions.
You know,
I don't think Dole would be very different.
You know, it's interesting. The only way we get our information on Israel and the occupied territories is often, I mean, the large population here in this country is from the press. We had Ari Shavidan, who had a very critical piece. He's an Israeli journalist on Israel's bombing of the Lebanese refugee camp. And he said, in his Israeli piece, apparently you noted this, that he said, we have the New York Times in our pocket. But when the New York Times ran the op-ed piece, they changed it to the press.
Yeah. on it, right? They changed it to the, well, they said they had adapted it, and they changed it from the New York Times to the American media. There were other interesting changes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Professor Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and author of numerous books on the issue of the Israeli occupation, as well as many others. Thanks for joining us. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Pat Greenfield and Erica Martinez at the studios of Pacifica Station WPFW here in Washington, D.C. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. You can purchase a copy by calling 1-800-735-0230. And if you'd like to call our listener hotline, you can call 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 588-0999, extension 313 in the 202 area code. Thanks very much for joining us for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!